September 7th, day 18. Our next stop was in the big city, where we caught a glimpse of the many specialty artisans that make San Francisco such an interesting and creative place. Also, if you're lucky, or unlucky, depending on how you look at it, you might even witness a naked dude walking his miniature dog down the street.
That's the voice of Dan Malloy, narrating in his latest project, Slow is Fast. It's actually a book and DVD combination pack in which he's partnered with photographer Kanoa Zimmerman and filmmaker Kellen Keane. It's available through Patagonia Books. The next few minutes of audio was recorded at a screening of Slow is Fast at the Hobie Surf Shop in Dana Point, California.
All right, yeah, thanks again, you guys, for coming out. I'm just going to do a quick little introduction of this project. It was about 2 years ago now that I was doing a road trip with a friend of mine, Kellen, who's here. He has the guy with possibly the biggest beard in the house, but maybe not. There's someone else, too. But we were doing a road trip up to Oregon, and I was telling Kellen about an idea that I had of riding our bikes down the coast. And, you know, after I got out of high school, I surfed professionally for on the tour and all that stuff for a good 10 years and had a blast doing it. But when I was about 28, I started to really want to learn more about the place that I was from. And, you know, traveling is amazing. It's really kind of addicting because you get to leave all of those things that kind of pile up and all, you know, work and family and all these things that make it a little bit harder to be present at home. And so I got really addicted to this idea of traveling and the feeling of it, but I wanted to feel that same thing at home because there's so much history and there's so much, you know, there's so much for us to learn and understand at home. You know? But, anyway, I just really wanted to start to appreciate my coastline and instead of always, you know, dreaming of leaving, start to understand where we were from a little bit more. So that's where the concept for this trip came from, was to get on the road, but be at home and really try to see all the people along our coastline and the places the same way that you do when you're on a trip in Europe or, you know, in Asia or whatever it is. So, so I told Kellen about the idea and he held me to it. And so we hit the road. It was about a 2 month trip down the coast. And there was three of us. We had one surfboard, a couple pairs of swim fins, and a couple cameras. And we stayed with people. Big inspiration for the trip was just agriculture in general, mostly small, medium scale agriculture. Has been really inspiring for me in the last 10 years or so. I think, you know, we're all a lot more connected to farming than we think. You know, if you eat, you're really, you know, closely connected to somebody that's growing your food every day. And that has really started to sink in with me. And I've wanted to get to know the people who are farming and you know, raising the animals that we eat and the vegetables that we eat. And it's really enriched my life a lot to get to know those people. So a big inspiration for this trip was to go meet those people, meet people that are doing cutting-edge organic farming along the coast. So it was kind of a combination of surfing and riding our bikes and meeting these people and working with them a lot, too. I want to thank Steve Barlotti's here tonight. He came in when we were trying to make our first book ever and just totally saved our butts because we didn't know what we were doing. And he spent the last week and a half with us working his butt off, really helped us out. He's here tonight, so I want to thank him very much. And everyone else who helped out with the project. And I think that's about it. Thanks, you guys. I hope you enjoy the film.
Welcome to Surf Splendor. I'm your host, David Scales. In today's episode, I have a conversation with Dan Malloy and Kellen Keane. We talked to Dan about where he's been, where he's going, and this latest project, Slow is Fast, which is available through a link on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. Thank you for joining us. We're glad that you found us, and we hope that you enjoy today's show.
Kind of simple. We grew up in Ojai, California, so it's not that far away from the industry.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we were in this little bubble, and we weren't a part of the whole scene at all. We grew up really detached from it, and so we my dad taught us how to surf when we were kids, but we wouldn't have run-ins with any professional surfers or any industry stuff, you know, and so. From a really young age, we were completely smitten with the whole industry
and
the
deal.
100%. We would watch every single video that came out, and we're just head over heels to be involved in any way that we could. We wanted to be pro surfers so bad it was a joke, you know, like that. We were dying to do it.
Were there pro surfers in that area at the time?
Not many. Okay. You know, there were a handful of guys. There's a guy named Barry Wilson. There were some older guys that were part of the competitive scene, but this is actually even before that. This is when we would be surf Emmalwood every day. We just had no outside real influences or contact besides the videos and seeing the magazines. But we were just in a bubble. We weren't surfing in competitions at the time. We were just surfing and having a good time. And so when we started to get to compete a little bit, and we started to get sponsorships and all that, it was just so much fun for us. We were just having a total blast. So we went in head first and, you know, never really, like, from that point on, we were like, okay, it's on. And I think basically what happened is it was this like good 15-year exploration into the surf industry of like what that is. And the first 5 years is just pure fun and games, going, oh my God, I just got a new sponsor and they'll pay for my boat trips, you know? And like, you know, it first just started out as a way to travel and surf and have a good time. That was just so much fun. And then you get into the next level where you're starting to compete on a higher level, and you're kind of used to the sponsorships, and you're used to getting to go on the trips you want to go on.
Were your parents supportive of that? I mean, even living in Orange County, if I tried to explain to my parents when I was in high school that people were going to pay me to travel, they would be a little bit surprised by that. Maybe reluctant to let me leave the country, I would think, you know?
For sure. My parents were really supportive, but to a certain extent, you know, it was like, we were all expected to move out of the house when we got out of high school.
Okay.
No second thoughts. If we didn't go to school, there was no thought of any secondary support of any kind, like any help of any kind. If we didn't go to school, you're just on your own, and we chose not to. So they were very supportive, and they were never negative toward it. And at the same time, they weren't like, you know, it was like, you're on your own if you're doing this.
Right.
When we're really excited about it, but, you know. But they were great, super supportive.
Cool.
And so we just gave it a crack. It was super all encompassing. We were stoked. That's all I've ever wanted to do from the time I was like 13 was be a, you know, pro surfer.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but at the same time, I think what happened was, is that we were so smitten by it all that we kind of weren't paying too close of attention. We were just doing it. And I think over a certain amount of time, we kind of realized that the surf industry wasn't really necessarily like the entire reason that we wanted to be involved. And it wasn't so much, you know, we had a lot of my youth. I spent, you know, in my mid-20s through to my mid-20s, I spent in Southern California. And I really, really feel a lot more connected to, you know, Ventura, Ojai, Santa Barbara, and North in California.
Sure.
So I think a big part of the shift was just was just kind of coming back home a little bit and getting back to surfing for those, for some of the more simple reasons. You know, I kind of threw a lot of layers on top of surfing there for a while, and I still continue to, you know, having it be a big part of your job and all this stuff. And I think that, you know, my next kind of mission is to slowly tear back all the different kind of shit that I've put on top of surfing, you know, because it can be such a simple peer experience, but when it becomes your job, it can also be a lot more than that. So
what were some of those layers? The Orange County lifestyle that you didn't like, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was for sure part of it. And but just competing a ton.
Yeah.
I was pretty competitive and I enjoyed it sometimes, but it didn't do, I think competition for certain people really brings out the best in them. Like, or best, it depends on how you look at it, but they become a better surfer or, you know, baseball player or whatever it is because of competition. And I watched that around me and it was really easy. It wasn't, when I quit competing, it wasn't so much that I was anti-competition. I mean, that's the way I kind of framed it, and the industry kind of framed it and all that stuff. But now that I've grown up a little bit, it was more that it wasn't bringing out the best in me for sure. Like, it wasn't making me a better surfer. I actually really felt like I plateaued and wasn't surfing better and was super stagnant. And then I was watching guys like Kelly and Andy, especially Andy, because he was my age. He was maybe 4 months younger than me, and I got to watch, we grew up surfing competition together, you know, and I got to watch competition bring out, like, basically create one of the best surfers that ever lived.
Right.
Like, when Andy was younger, he was a really good surfer, don't get me wrong, but did I ever think he was going to be three-time world champ? That wasn't what I was thinking when he was a grommet.
Right.
And I think through his competitive drive with Bruce and just his competitive drive in general, he became one of the greatest surfers of all time.
Right.
And I watched that happen. It really informed me on how competition affected me. I'm like, wow, it doesn't do that for me. When I need, you know, an 8.5 or a 9 with 30 seconds left to go, I don't get a wave and surf the best I've ever surfed in my life.
Right.
And that's what I would see around me. So it was just really experience and time doing it that kind of made me realize that wasn't the exact road for me.
It seems though, like, your background obviously formed you and where you were at that stage in your life, just like Andy's probably formed him. And it seems like coming from your farming kind of agricultural background that you had more diverse set of things in your life that you found fulfillment in, and there's kind of a more of a work ethic involved, I think, with growing up in where you grew up that I think I see similarities to with other people who have come out of that area since then, whether it's like Dane or Bobby or Morgan Mawson, photographers, and Chris, you know, like, there's just kind of a more diverse interests that those people share, because I feel like they had to work for it a little bit, or they just had an upbringing that, I don't know, relied on work ethic. Orange County, on the other hand, the surfers, young surfers coming out of Orange County, it's 100% surfing 100% of the time, which I think is dangerous, you know, and it's a recipe for burnout oftentimes. And I don't know, if you're getting all of your value and worth out of one thing, that can be, I don't know, there's pitfalls to that.
Yeah, there's a lot there to what you just said. It's, I think when you hit Malibu from Malibu South, it's a really different mentality. It's,
yeah.
I mean, it is 100% different. And there's a lot of things that change when you get to Ventura. And one of them, one of the major things is that being a pro surfer is almost frowned upon, pretty much frowned upon. And having, you know, having all the coolest new gear with all the stickers on your board is, by some of the best surfers in town, is considered, like, you have to earn your respect even more if you're going to do that.
Right.
So there's this real, and it's kind of a double-edged sword, you know? In one way, I appreciate it more than anything in the world, because you just go, okay, you know, I was lucky enough and had enough support when I was a kid, and all the things fell into play to where I get this shot at being a pro surfer. And on the other hand, you're going, like, okay, like, I know very clearly that some of the coolest, best surfers that I know don't think that's, you know,
The
be all end all of what we're doing here. There's a lot more to surfing. And I mean, if you look, it's like, look at Dane, look at Bobby, look at Tom Curran. They're every one of those, like every, you know, it seems like almost all the surfers that come out of Ventura have this gnarly chip on their shoulder of some kind. And it's, they express it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
They have all done it in different ways, but there's something that has kind of kept them from being like, I mean, if you're a very successful pro surfer in San Diego, you're like a god,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
And up there, it's kind of, it's just not the way it is.
Right.
It's just not the way it is.
It's good though. It's grounding, you know, because it isn't the most important. You're not changing the world.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. You're not even close to changing anything.
Yeah.
And so, so I've always really appreciated that. And I know my mom and dad were, like I said, they were supportive, but they didn't think it was the biggest deal in the world.
Right.
And that was a big influence on me. And so I just think we had, some kind of appreciation that this is an unbelievable opportunity to go get to do some of the things we've always dreamt of doing, but by no means is it the most important thing you can be doing.
You know? Talking about some of the diversity in your background, I remember reading, and I haven't been able to verify this on the internet, but I remember reading a long time ago something about you almost being a professional snakeboarder.
That's really funny. I was like, what are you going to say right now?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't even close. But
was that a thing, though?
Do you remember those things?
For a moment, I remember they came, and then...
Yeah, do you know that, those things? They're these funny skateboard things that like, you...
It's hinged in the middle, right?
Yeah, it's hinged in the middle.
Are your feet strapped to it?
No.
Okay.
I could pick stuff like that up pretty quick.
Okay.
And when I got into high school, we lived in a normal little neighborhood and, you know, had a nice smooth road. And I just picked it up really fast compared to all my other friends. There was no thought or chance. I wasn't even...
Okay.
You know, there were people that were way, 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 way better. I don't know.
Were there professionals even?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Someone must have just wrote that somewhere, but I don't, not even close.
I mean, at the time I read it, there was only magazines. There was no internet, so it had to be in a magazine, and it might have just been a joke or an exaggeration.
It must have been.
They knew you were good at that, so they just referenced it.
Yeah.
It was a trend like shorter than the Razor or the Heelys or anything,
and just
like that.
About as dorky as the Razor too,
possibly,
or maybe even worse. So
what about modeling? You were doing modeling outside the surf industry, right?
Yeah, that's like the dark ages of
is it?
For me. Yeah. talk about the really embarrassing stuff. So when I was like 20 or something like that, or 18 or whatever, Kelly was doing this interview. And he was like, hey, I'm doing this interview. They want to take a shot with some friends. And I went down there, and the guy was like this super big-time fashion dude.
Okay. Photographer?
You know? Yeah.
Okay.
And so once a year for like 3 years after that, I would get a call. And I didn't have to like audition or anything like that. And they'd just be like, hey, if you show up there, we'll pay you $3,000 or $4,000 a day for 5 days. And you can hang out with hot chicks and and I was a kid and I was kind of like, whoa, this is awesome. But I will say, that was, for me, it was kind of, it wasn't that much fun for me. It was kind of unsettling and strange. And I mean, it makes sense really. Like, you're getting paid all this money and doing all this stuff off of something you don't have anything to do with. And
sure.
The decisions are being made. Like, it's just kind of unsettling and ungrounding. And there were some fun moments here and there, but like, I wouldn't, I really, that whole deal, I try not to think about or pursue very much.
Well, let me ask you this. Like, I could see that this doesn't relate to my life in any other way. And if it stops tomorrow, I'm fine. I would never miss it.
Mm-hmm.
But I have trouble sympathizing with the part of it being unsettling. Like, because it's a good paycheck. I'm here to collect.
Oh, totally.
And I'll check out tomorrow and I'm fine with that.
No,
but what part of
no sympathy needed. Just for me, it was just a little bit of a strange experience. It's like, well, because you get that paycheck and then you're like, cool, maybe I can start expecting that. And then you're like, whoa, I don't want to start expecting this. This is really strange. This whole thing is just freaking weird, you know? So you just have to be like, okay, take those for what they are. I'm not like, I really don't want to start pursuing that. That's the last thing in the world. I'm like, you know what? I still can, you know, like, my trips are still getting paid for. Like, I'm still doing fine as a surfer. Like, I'm going to just stick to that.
Sure.
You know? And, sure. And I want to be, you know, in on boat trips with friends and, you know, spending time in Hawaii and doing all that stuff. And when, if the, it's a really hard thing to turn down.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not something I'm very interested in.
Sure.
I think I have a couple scars now that prohibit me from doing that, which is great, which is like the perfect, right. You know, anecdote.
Well, that's a good segue into kind of slow is fast and kind of being more thoughtful with your life choices, I suppose. Tell me about the project and the impetus behind the trip.
It came after almost 15 years of being on the road surfing, and I definitely have been drawn. It was when I was about 29 years old, or about then, it was like a switch went off that I all of a sudden would be on trips and be really thinking about home a lot. I'd never had that. I'd never been homesick in my life, and so I just started to think and kind of understand that traveling is an amazing feeling, and it's an amazing thing to do, and it's you know, not everybody gets the opportunity to do it, but it's also, there's so much at home to see and experience and do, and you just not often it's not often that you're in that frame of mind where you can really take it all in and enjoy it like you do when you're on the road.
Sure.
And I kind of have been really interested in that whole concept for a good while now, about, okay, how do you get into that kind of beginner's mind thing where when you have a moment that's not dealing with logistics and, you know, work and family and all these things that can be a little bit, I don't want to say distracting because they are your life, but like when you're in the midst of that, how can you appreciate where you are? Because it's even more applicable to your, it's even rich, more of a rich experience if you can get there.
Live
in
the moment.
Yeah, if you can actually, yeah. So the idea of doing, like figuring out how to change a couple details and be, you know, relatively at home,
sure.
But change a few details to where you really feel like you're on the road. Like really actually feel like you're on a gnarly, you know, adventure.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do if you're like, well, we'll just jump in the car. Mm-hmm. And so Kellen and I were on a road trip up to Oregon, and we were talking about this idea of doing a long bike ride down the coast and really like taking some time to do it and all that. And he was like, hey, you got to do it. Let's do it. And so he kind of like ignited the fire and was like, hey, let's set a date. Like, this is when I can do it. When can you do it? Come on, come on, come on. So all of a sudden we started planning this trip. I think when we started out, it was going to be a little over a month, and it ended up being about 2 months in the end. And I know not that many people can take that much time off.
Sure.
But I also know that you could get a really great experience in 3 days or a week within this format. Like, it's a really fun way to travel.
Yeah.
It was definitely one of the best trips I've ever been on, for sure. Yeah, it was amazing.
Wow. Let's get Kellen's voice in here real quick. Kellen, what was the objective for the trip, basically? What was the goal? Did you have it outlined, a start point and a stop point? And what was the goal to do along the way?
Yeah, I don't think there was much of a goal, you know. The goal was to, you know, me and Dan and Kanoa is the third partner.
Project a little bit.
Yeah.
Speak right into there.
It was just to kind of head down the coast and try and have some fun and learn what we could from some people that really inspired us and were doing stuff that we're interested in learning more about. And if there was a goal, it was just to, you know, slow down and check in with those people and, you know, surf and camp our way down the coast and have a good time.
Where was the starting point?
We started up in Mendocino County. Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. We ended in Ventura County.
Okay.
So we zigzagged, though. You know, we were inland and coastal, and so we kind of snaked our way down the coast.
Is it 500 miles? Is that what turned out?
I think it was 700.
Yeah, 700 miles. Something like that. Okay.
I think so.
Which isn't much. It's not
on a bicycle.
It wasn't a big bike ride,
you could do that ride though.
We were with people that were doing the similar. We'd go. We'd see people and they're telling us about coming down from Canada, going to Baja, and we're doing this little sliver. So on a bike, on the grand scheme of things, biking wise, it was a fun little part of the coast. But for us, it was I'm not a biker. Well, I was the weakest link.
Yeah, there was people doing what the same distance that we did in doing it in a week.
Yeah,
wow.
We did it in 2 months.
But they were just crazy. Powering, you know.
So you talk about meeting with people along the way and learning from them. Did you have those people picked out prior to leaving, or was it just people that you met on the road?
It was a little of both, right?
We kind of each picked a few people that in our, you know, we started, it was kind of cool. We started up, Kanoa lives in San Francisco. And so we kind of started in the northern part. And then I live in the central coast in San Luis Obispo. So I was kind of the central, and then Dan lives in Ventura, that area, Lompoc, and so I was kind of the southern. So we kind of each picked a few people that were really inspired by to learn from, and went and spent time with them.
Give me an insight, like who are one or two of the people, and what are they involved in, and what did you link up with them and do?
One of the first families that we stayed with was the Merch family. It's Mickey is the husband, Bronwyn the wife, and their kids live up in Bolinas, and they run just this really beautiful little organic farm. Mickey went to school to I don't know if it was art school, but yeah, it's just a really smart family. They're third generation on that farm, and basically have the knowledge and the wherewithal to kind of do whatever he wants, you know.
Okay.
And he chooses very specifically to farm, and he's one of the hardest working people I've ever seen. And so we stayed with them for, I think, 5 days.
Yeah.
And worked with them a lot. It was like loosely based off of that, what people they call woofing, that organization, worldwide organization of organic farms.
Right.
Where you can go, and if you don't have dough, you can go and stay and work there, you trade for your work.
Oh, okay.
So we didn't do that, but it was kind of loosely based off of that idea.
Sure.
So we would go and work hard with these people and learn what we could. And then we would document what they were doing a little bit, but at the end. But it was much less like we documented a lot less on this trip than almost any trip I've ever been on. It was kind of an experiment, in my opinion, to not just let the documenting side like trample all over the actual experience. Like that's so much of the industry is built off of imagery now that. You know, the entire reason why you're going on the trip in the first place is to get a few photos.
Right.
So,
and it's pinpointed with a swell,
yeah.
Like on a specific window. And yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so this trip was definitely like, I was like, well, can we, it was an independent project at first, you know, Patagonia Books picked it up, after it did okay, but they were really unsure about it at first. but anyway, it was like, I mean, my favorite photos are all those amazing photos from the 50s and 60s of climbing and surfing, where the photographs were just an artifact of what happened. You know, someone wasn't there documenting every last thing. There was like a few shots from what was happening. And I was just curious to see if you could still get decent, if you could still tell a decent story without basically trampling all over the situation in the first place.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think we filmed and we shot photos, but a lot less than we usually do. We just let some stuff go, and it was really, it worked out.
Okay.
I was proud of how it came out.
I totally struggle with that myself. Like, if you're looking through a viewfinder, you're really missing the experience, you know, and you're not just enjoying the trip or whatever it is. The concern would be you're going to miss experiences you're going to miss capturing experiences because you wanted to just enjoy it. Did you feel like the end product suffered at all from not capturing everything?
I think it kind of like richened
the
imagery that we got, because you're there, you know, with each person or with each spot for a limited time. And, you know, if you put those first few days in just to sinking in and like, you know, checking in with the land and checking in with the people and, you know, getting to know the whole scene, it kind of kind of left us with the last few days before we leave, or the last day when we did want to, you know, pull out the cameras with some really, you know, more, you know, more interesting imagery.
You're more steeped in the experience already.
Everyone's loosened up and
right.
I'll tell you what, too. It's like if you work your butt off for a couple of days with somebody, they're a lot more open to talking.
Right.
And it's not like we worked so they would open
up.
No,
of course.
But like they could tell we were genuinely interested in what they were doing, because I know for sure we were.
We were
very interested.
That's why we did it.
Yeah. And they're not just like, what are these guys doing? Like, why are they here with all these cameras and all this shit? They're like, oh, okay. Like, this is, I kind of know what's going on here. And we've already had some good talks over beers without all this stuff.
Right.
And it really, like, for me, you can only tell so much of the story. But the thing is that you had to commit the time, because normally you're like, oh, all we need is 2 days to get what we need.
Sure.
And you're not. So it was after 5 days, you know, and you when you're there for 5 days, you can set back. The other thing is that this was an independent project, and our major expense was food. We weren't spending a ton of money, so we could make those risks.
Right.
So there was this really interesting balance that I hadn't experienced in a long time, where you're like, you know, we're making this project and it's taking 2 months. It's a lot of time and effort and emotion and all that stuff, but we're not risking this big budget from a company.
Yeah.
We're not risking this, that, or the other thing. So it allowed us to just like be like, well, look, nobody's expecting anything from this project.
Right.
So let's, you know, and like we said, we didn't have a treatment written up. We didn't, we were like, let's go see if the end result can come after, like see what happens and then make something out of it. So
Nice to be able to have the luxury to actually take that time and do that.
It sure was.
Why do you think the mainstream media doesn't cover stories like this? I mean, did you have any interest from any of the magazines about what you were doing? Or once the book is out, I would think that...
I've actually had more coverage from the mainstream media on this project than almost anything I've ever done.
Really?
Yeah. So the surf magazines did little things on it, which I was really appreciative about, for, you know, they took a second to check it out. And then once the book got into circulation, and I think the LA Times online thing did a really nice review, like a really great view. I was just waiting for them to tear it apart. I've never even, you know, it's the first little book we've ever published, and it was independent, you know, like it wasn't. And I was just waiting for this review to just tear us apart. And that was a really complimentary review. And since then, as far as like outside of surf industry, there's been more mainstream media attention than anything I've ever done.
What about the surf media specifically? You know, Surfer, Surfing, have they reviewed the book, or do they have any interest in what's going on?
Surfer did a short article
they
on
did.
It.
They did? Okay, cool.
Yeah, and it was cool.
Very cool.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think. They've all been pretty open to it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, not like, didn't make a, you know, it was a, you know what? To be honest, I don't blame the surf media for not doing more with it at all, because we didn't surf that much.
Oh, okay.
We did surf, you know? Right. I mean, the trip was partially about surfing.
Right.
But, you know, we were on bikes. Like, there was days when it was way better up there and we couldn't get there. And
yeah.
And we had very minimal gear to capture, so we have like a tiny little nugget of few images that kind of carried us through surfing wise. We surfed quite a bit, but
Dan's one board was on the back of his bob trailer, you know. That was our gear.
Yeah.
We all had wetsuits.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. Like, tell me about bicycle therapy, you know, and does that enrich the experience by itself?
Yes. the bike was fun for me. Before this trip, I had never biked more than 10 miles.
Oh, you know, really?
In my life. Yeah, so I came off the couch.
Dove into the deep end, dude. One,
and I was for sure the weakest link. And yeah, it was fun. I got into it. I really had a blast on the bike. You know, it definitely, you know, makes the water that much sweeter when you get in there and you know, clean off the dust and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, it just made the time at the beach rather than what the waves were doing that much more important and fun to be around, you know, just to be there after a, you know, day
working
riding your
for
bike.
It. Yeah.
Working for it. Just to be in the ocean and play around on whatever's available is pretty fun.
Who got sick?
I got sick.
That was you? What happened?
Some bad food in the valley.
Okay.
Yeah, bad food in the valley.
It was funny because we ate really great food the whole time, like the freshest food you could eat, and the one kind of gnarly biker...
Hang with Dan's cowboy.
Yeah, gnarly place that was just like, you could tell it was kind of gross, but we were like, whatever, we're hungry. And Kellen just got deathly ill.
Like food poisoning or...
Yeah, really bad. It was really one of the worst ones I've ever got. It was bad. It was we
sick for almost a week.
We were what it was is we were at a place where it was just a bad place to be sick. You know, we were 30 miles from any road, and we were back in this canyon with no running water, no electricity, on Dan's friend's ranch. Well, not his ranch, but some land that he took care of, and it's just a bad place to be sick.
I think I saw that photo in the scoop of a tractor. Basically, they were giving you a ride because you couldn't ride your bike.
I gotta thank Graham Goodfield for getting me out of there.
And the guy that so he got you out of there in a buggy, in an old
covered wagon,
buckboard,
style.
Buckboard
wagon,
and then,
with a
And then we were out on the road, and this guy named John Karam was the guy who in the forklift.
On a forklift, and he was a farm. He was a pistachio farmer in the Cuyama Valley.
Yeah,
yeah.
One of the things I will say that, like, as far as the bike goes, that I thought was something I didn't expect, and was kind of like one of the major things I took away from the trip, was that people, like, I've only experienced it overseas when you go around and people are like, hey, where are you from? What's going on? And they're like, hey, we're having a barbecue. Come over.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, this is weird. This doesn't happen.
They're enamored because you're an American.
I found is that it has nothing to do with being overseas.
Okay.
When we were on bikes, if you don't look like a complete bum, which we did some days, but some days we didn't.
Yeah.
You have your gear, you have the food you need, you're totally self-contained, but you're on a pretty awesome mission, and they can kind of tell what's going on, that you're doing something fun. People seem to totally just be drawn to it, and they're like, okay, this person isn't asking for anything.
Yeah.
They're totally self-contained, they can get to where they're going, but, you know, like, honestly, it seems like people are drawn into it. And we had, I swear to God, it seemed like every other day someone invited us to crash out at their place and stay for dinner, and like, and I've never had that in California. And it was happening, it seemed like it was happening every day.
Yeah.
And so that was a really, really fun takeaway to me, and it was kind of what I don't know, that's kind of what I thought was amazing. It was like we were in California seeing it like we'd never seen it before.
Yeah,
we really were. And like, I don't want to get too like romanticize the concept too much, but I'll tell you what, it was freaking weird.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
I think listeners aren't all in Southern California, of course, so they don't understand how rude people are here.
Yeah.
I did a family trip back to Tennessee in June, and it blew me away that people were so friendly.
Southern hospitality.
Totally. Yeah. They waved you, strangers driving the opposite direction on the road just waved to you.
Oh, yeah.
You walk in to get a coffee, they say hello.
Yes, sir. Yes, people, ma'am.
Yeah. People don't understand. In Southern California, you could walk into Starbucks, they just look up at you and wait for you to tell you their order. You
know? Yeah.
Like the cashier doesn't say, how are you? Can I help you?
Yeah.
And so that is surprising to me that you would get some of that the beaten path.
We got a ton of it. Yeah. And it was like the thing I was trying to figure it out, because it's really strange how many, not only like how many people are really hospitable and just fun to be around, but just in general, how many, how often there would be a coincidence.
That, and I think which it led to like crazy nights and fun stories and like, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it just had to do with, one being outside of the frame and being in a car, like, oh, hey, yeah, it is good to see you, but I'm going to go right now. Like, mm-hmm. you're always, you had more time. But it just, you really create this space where you're like, well, we don't have to be anywhere tonight.
Right.
Like, we really don't have to be anywhere. And, like, we told them we'd be there in 2 days, and we can call them and let them know that we're going to be, they know we're on a bike. Like, you just create this space all of a sudden.
Right.
And you're like, well, we could either ride for 3 hours right now, or we can go over and have tea with this freaking weirdo guy who offered us some tea. Like, and it just changes the dynamic so much,
right.
and really made for a good time. Like, I would recommend anybody going on a trip like this, at home or close by or whatever.
In the piece you did recently on Esquire.com, you talked about farming and how people refer to it as a simpler way of life. And then you argued that farming is about as hard of a way of life as you could think of. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I'm not, you know, like a full-on farmer or anything like that. I just, for me, that's something I'm really interested in. My wife and I do have a little farm that my good friend mostly does a lot of the organic farming, and I take care of the orchard, and my wife has goats, and we have chickens and dogs and pigs and all that stuff. But I definitely don't call myself like a good farmer by any means. I have a long, long way to go. But I just think that you know, being the steward of any land at all is super complex.
Yeah.
And people think it's, you know, it's this like quaint old country thing. But if you want to turn a profit or get by at all as a farmer, it's really difficult, you know, and it's harder now than ever before, because it's hard to, the cost of living is so high that, you know, the amount of money you can make off of your land isn't enough.
Right.
So, you know, there's the quaint, simple farming where if you're filthy, filthy rich and you can come home to a perfectly manicured farm, you know, for a few days every month, that's probably fun and simple. But actually working the land and everything like that, there's never an end to what needs to be done. And the people that are doing it well, I respect more than anything in the world. I really have been unbelievably just inspired by this crew of farmers. Like, I always, you know, I've been just realizing, like, if you start to find out who's growing your food and start to get to know those people, you will never regret it, because they're the most colorful, most interesting, totally trippy, but great people with a ton of insight. And since I kind of made that, you know, leap, like since I started to pay more attention, it's really been a huge shift in my life. I spent a lot of the time with the people who grow most of our food. I met my wife at the restaurant where I started going, because I knew the food was coming directly from the farm.
Wow.
And so it's been a big shift for me, and I'm not even close. I don't feel like that little spark of inspiration is even close. To being out, I continue to this day to be really inspired by what's happening in small scale agriculture, and that's how I kind of view environmentally. That's where I think there's a ton of opportunity there, and it's just fun. It's a great way to to spend our time. I think we all eat a few times a day. We're all pretty darn connected to farms, whether we know it or not. You know?
Sure. A theme that continually comes up on this podcast, no matter who we're talking to, is just the business of surfing.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of alluded to it a little bit about this trip starting off as just a privately funded project, mm-hmm. and it turning into something else. Travel is expensive, obviously, and most surf trips, as we talked about, have a specific objective targeted with a swell, and we're going to promote this new board short line or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
This trip really seems like the antithesis of that.
Mm-hmm.
Patagonia's relationship in your life, are they pretty much just hands off and allow you to kind of dictate where you go, when you go, or how does that relationship work?
It really just depends. It's kind of changing all the time. I've been working for Patagonia for 10 years now.
Okay.
And it just depends on what's going on. Now, definitely, you know, my role is still to surf a ton, which is kind of unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that. And about 50% of it is that, and about 50% of that is working on book and film projects.
Okay.
And it just really depends on what's going on. Yeah, I mean, it's for sure, Patagonia is a business that's doing really, really well, and there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah.
You know, they're, I wouldn't say it's just this hands-off thing. I spend a lot of time in there working with the designers and the R&D crew.
Oh, okay.
And the marketing crew and the surf, side of things. And there's a lot going on, and it's not far from home, and I enjoy the company there, and everybody works really hard, and
right.
there's all the ups and downs of business, you know?
Yeah.
But I really, couldn't be more thankful for the group of people that end up working at Patagonia. You know, really met some of my best friends there. And but you know, it's like any business. There's good times and bad times, and mm-hmm. there's you know, times when things are simpler than others. But it's been a really good run.
So when you're going on trips, let's say other than this trip, do they have a crew documenting it, or how does it work differently?
It always changes.
Okay.
Sometimes they'll have somebody in mind to document it, and it will come from Patagonia. Hey, we heard about this trip.
Sure.
You want to go, and we'll send this staff, you know, either Jeff Johnson or Tim Davis or something like that. And then sometimes it'll be completely disconnected from Patagonia. I'll have heard about a trip or want to do a trip. And
yeah.
I'll get in touch with them and say, hey, this seems like a worthy thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
How's the timing or whatever, you know, they have a lot of trust in us for sure.
And yeah.
I think that's, you know, part of the reason my brothers and I have been able to do what we've done is that, we know it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
And you know, it's, you know, working with people is working with people, and it's communication, and it's working hard and making sure that the projects you work on, or, you know, if they're going to put time and energy and money into it, better work out for them too.
Completely.
And I think we've always had a really solid understanding of that, and like, you know, this isn't just like this random free ride. It's like they expect something, and so if you can give them at least what they expect, then there's probably a few more evenings where nobody's around and we're getting big stand-up barrels and nobody's even shooting
sure.
in store for us, so we don't mind sacrificing a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I can look back at some of the stuff I've done and been like, wow, that wasn't just purely the surfing experience, you know. Man, I'm a little bit of a sellout. But I also have, you know, still sneak in, you know, get to sneak in some sessions with nobody around that are the things that I cherish, and I don't mind working hard.
Yeah.
If we've agreed that that's what we're going to do and that's how we're going to do it, and if that, you know, if that, you know, allows me to go surfing, you know, and do things the way I want to do it when I'm not, you know, working, then that's fine.
Kind of related to the conversation of riding a bicycle or not pulling out the cameras on day one when you're on the farm, it seems like they've cultivated an environment where you can just enjoy the experience and be yourself, so that when it comes time to deliver a product, whether it be an image or a video or whatever, it's a authentic product that you're delivering, you know? That seems like a very different method of collecting content for them than it would be for one of the big five companies in Orange County or something.
Yeah, I think so. But it's always a struggle because when something works, it becomes an equation.
Okay.
For everybody.
Sure.
And so even at Patagonia, it's like, wow, that worked perfect. Let's do it again.
Right.
You know, and so I think it's actually not that simple, and that to get interesting stuff, you always have to be pulling, you know, kind of switching things up and going, yeah. You know, like, actually, how do we make this, like, authentic gets so, you know, thrown around. It's like, what does that even mean anymore? And you have to really be thinking about the trip and what it is or what's going on. And I think it takes a lot of work to get to tell stories in a way that are actually feel like they're coming from a good place and seem like they're not just a waste of people's time and not right. just like kind of silly marketing, you know?
Yeah. And I think Patagonia's done a great job with that, though. It feels everything that I've been exposed to from them feels authentic.
Yeah, know? They have had a really an unbelievable blueprint set for them by the early crew at Patagonia with Chris Tompkins and Rick Ridgway and Yvonne and Jennifer Ridgway and these people that were really, I think, ahead of their times as far as like just realizing that, like, look, people just want something that is that they can relate to, that's real.
Yeah,
they don't care if the photograph is technically perfect. They just want to see something that they can, you know, laugh at or connect with. And so I think the more that we lean back on the heritage of what Patagonia is, the better off we are.
Totally.
And there's some really great blueprints there. So that's the other thing. I feel lucky to be able to cross paths with those people and work in the same kind of lineage of what they started.
Right. Yeah, no, it seems like a great opportunity and a great fit.
Yeah.
I remember Yvonne talking about in his book just about the business surviving in spite of him. You know, uh-huh. just like his focus was so much on climbing that the business was hindering his climbing, and so he'd abandoned the business, but there was enough people around him who believed in that vision and that passion that he had that they supported him in that endeavor, propped him up, you know? And,
yeah.
And I think that is... The market responds to that, you know, and recognizes that authenticity. And I feel like a lot of the big surf brands started that way, probably, mm-hmm. but have grown too big for their britches and have kind of abandoned the original core group of surfers that once built their business.
Yeah.
And maybe I think that has to do with Kelly leaving Quiksilver an extent and starting that Outer Known brand. And I know Luke Egan just started... Depactus is what he's calling it,
mm-hmm.
which are almost designed to compete with Patagonia. Yeah, you know, they're like outdoorsy type brands.
What's interesting to me about that is it's exciting, first of all, and I'm so excited to see what Kelly and Luke are doing. And what's classic too, though, is that they, you know, the way I really see it is the surf industry, the companies actually, if you look at everything from energy drinks to a lot of the surf companies, they're marketing companies that make clothing.
Right.
Or they're a marketing company that makes a drink. Like, what's Red Bull?
Fully.
It's a marketing company.
Fully, yeah.
It's not a drink company.
Right.
And I think Patagonia's been able to retain its status as being a clothing company that also does marketing to let people know that the clothes are out this season. And there's a ton of strength in that because our marketing at times isn't great. I mean, I've seen it and it's not perfect, but the product actually continues to sell even when our marketing is not great. Whereas the other brands, if the marketing is not perfectly on point, it's just like, cause you could switch all the stuff around. When it comes to the clothing, you could switch the logos around and you can't tell the difference, you know? So it's really about marketing. So what will be interesting is that, I can't wait to see what those guys are up to because they're way, way, way better at marketing than we are.
Hmm.
You know, that's what their whole entire, you know, world has been steeped in is marketing. So I know for a fact they're not going to put out a product that touches ours for a really long time. I give them like 15 years before they can do that.
Well, there's so many systems that you have to put into place.
There are so many systems. Yeah. And that's the one thing I don't know. It's hard to understand if you... I said I've been at Patagonia for 10 years and I'm just starting to scratch the surface of how much time and energy has gone into making, you know, things like Ulex and things like the Vest and all that stuff. Like, it is ridiculous. And so I know that making those products is going to be really difficult, but the marketing part, I think they're going to nail it.
Yeah.
And I think that it's going to, the gap that we saw in the market 10 years ago, which was basically that, you know, there's all these surfers that there's so many surfers in the world that don't necessarily align with the messaging that the big five surf brands are putting out, but they don't, those people don't have a choice. That's right. All there is. And Patagonia has this amazing ethos, and we can easily, you know, let them know that we're actually committed to surfing too. And but now we're going to have a handful of brands that realize there's that huge gap, and they realize there's this huge group of people that aren't looking for like the really tech competitive side of surfing, and that are looking for something else. And I bet you it's going to be really enticing and really fun, and I'm excited about it.
Something you said right now about them speaking to a market that hasn't had a home really, mm-hmm. other than Patagonia. And I think it relates to what we talked about with you growing up, which is just like these companies, Patagonia, represent a variety of sports other than just surfing. You know, it's like climbing and fishing and all these other things. And I think that you're right. There's so many people out there who do things other than just surf.
Yeah.
And so it's nice to have Mark Healy as a representative of yeah. your company, you yeah. know, or somebody like that.
Yeah, Healy is the, you cannot go wrong with that guy.
Yeah.
He's so such a badass and so personable, and, you know, you just want to know what he's up to.
Yeah.
Like, it's amazing, and he's good at relaying what he's been doing, and so I think that's a good call.
It enriches your surfing experience, though, to have all those other things that you do in your life,
yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
So I think that it'll be interesting to see kind of how the surf culture changes, I guess, with these brands in the marketplace,
yeah,
where it's not just all surf all the time.
Yeah, I know? Think it'll be great. I think it'll push everybody. And totally. I'm stoked that Kelly, you know, went for it, you know, because mm-hmm. it's just a lot of pressure. And he got a ton of support from Quiksilver, and even though you might not be in support of how they do business, you know, there were people supporting you for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
You have all these great friends. So I know it took a lot for him to do that, and I'm hoping, you know, I have high hopes for what they do, you know.
Yeah.
I'm super curious, you know. I'm like, oh, can't wait to see the first stuff, you know.
Yeah.
See what it is, how it looks.
Time will tell.
Yep.
Let's talk about surf films.
All right.
And Callan would be a good person to chime in on this conversation as well. Kind of the evolution of surf films, kind of documentary style films early on. Taylor Steele's 45-minute action flicks came about, and now it's distilled down to just 2-minute rip clips basically on the web. The medium has changed drastically. Callan, this is your project as a filmmaker. What is your gauge on the current surf film market? What do you like about it? Is this intended to be any part of that at all? And do you have reverence for exists?
This is Dan. This is ours together, and I think Dan's got a lot more history in the surf film world. So it's,
I don't feel. This was not an entry into the current state of surf.
It's not
films. No, I mean they're honestly, like, I think there's probably a 15 waves in the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
and not one would be considered a B plus ride,
yeah.
or not even a C. You know.
Okay.
So this was, I mean, this book was really inspired by this book and film, and, you know, we've called the films extra features from the get-go, extra features to the book. You know, was really inspired, that the feel of the book and all that was inspired by this book, a couple of books, but this one by Margaret Kilgallen, this really awesome artist from San Francisco who was a sign painter, and she put out this beautiful book, and it was just this simple, it was like this amazing simple experience to have the book and look through it. And to me, it kind of when I had it with me, it was like kind of time stood still, and I wanted to make something with these guys that was like that. Like, you open it up and it was just a simple experience. So it really I always hope that the stuff I'm working on is enjoyed by surfers. Like, I'm a surfer through and through. That's what I want that's the only like group I really know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was coming from, I knew it wasn't going to mix in right with the rest of the stuff. But
in the book itself, how much is it text? How much text is there in it? Is there a storyline or a narrative, or how does it work?
It's pretty much just the exact chronological order of the trip and how we went on it. And it's a short, you know, 2 or 3 pages on each person that we came in contact with captions. It's kind of more of like an art book. There's some excerpts from the interviews that we did. We did long interviews, and I'd put like 3 answers in there. I edited the hell out of them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to overdo it with text.
It's a photo journal book with
some interviews, and cool. then the video is just a compliment to the book.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What about surf films in general? Like, how do you process them nowadays? And do you enjoy the current platform of just like these 2-minute? I mean, what are your guys' thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's definitely fun to watch them, you know, but you definitely still miss those, you know, the original ones, the full length, the DVD platform, you know?
Yeah.
You watch it on a screen or, you know, watch it on your TV. But it's getting shorter and shorter, and it makes it fun. You get to see a bunch of rad stuff going on around the world, but I still love the experience of you know, sitting down and watching a movie.
But do you? Do you sit down? Do you take the time now to sit down and watch them?
Yeah.
You do?
Sure. Well, I mean, for what's out there, you know?
Yeah.
I haven't been lately because I don't have a TV at our house, but I mean, we have computers, so it's not like we're not watching screens all freaking day. But so I watch less surf films, but I do really enjoy that experience. And I feel like, you know, that was how we learned how to surf, was watching films, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know? And one of the things I will say about it is that I, like, honestly, it's so crazy. Kids will do the most amazing turn or trick or error or whatever, and people remember it for about a week.
Right.
And I feel bad for the kids because when we were coming up, you would work on a whole section for a year.
Yeah.
And then it would come out, and it was a huge deal for a year.
Yeah.
Like, you'd have a whole year. If you kicked ass and really put something decent together, you had, like, a whole year, and you were, like, you basically, like, if you were working on a Taylor Steele film, you had good sponsorships and all that stuff.
Right.
Now something will come out. I remember when, I draw blanks, but those kids from Maui.
Yeah, Matt Miola and Albie Lair.
Yeah, and when Albie did that freaking double ollie-oop.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it was a big deal. Like, people did hear about it, but like, to me, I was like, oh my God. And it just seemed like it happened and then kind of passed by.
Completely.
And I was like, oh my God.
Perfect example on the train ride down here. Me and Dan are, you know, we're in and out of internet service on the way down, and he shows me this clip.
Of Koa Smith.
Koa Smith getting a minute long barrel.
In Namibia. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah.
Longest tube I think I've ever seen on film. And
it was gnarly.
And it hasn't really stuck with me, you know, like I, you know, but
yeah.
It's just another.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's the craziest thing I've ever seen. But totally. Yeah, it's just such a different experience.
Like, it is.
Not, like, if that was in a. Hard to explain, but
yeah, so
if that was in a different
on the
goes.
On the flip side of what Dan's talking about, I was watching those Taylor Steele movies when they came out, and I can tell you, or I probably maybe not anymore, but I could tell you at the time anyways what song each surfer had and what turn they were doing to that drum beat in that part of a song. Like, if I listen to that song later on my Walkman,
that's
I could be like,
your mind.
Yeah, oh, yeah. This is when Kelly did that turn at J Bay to Unwritten Law in Good Times. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Superman was the song.
And
so I watched that 1,000 times. Now I'll watch a clip once and move on. And I like John John's movie that he made, Done, I think is what it was, a year or two ago.
Uh-huh.
I paid for it online. It's still on my computer. I think I've watched it twice.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was by all measures a better film than any of Taylor Steele's in terms of the surfing and whatever. But I watched it twice and I moved on with my life.
Yeah,
it's like, I don't know if the medium has changed so much that I'm less engaged, or if I've changed so much that my attention span is shorter.
Yeah.
You know? I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah. No, it's changed. That's for sure. You know, before it was almost like, you got the film, it was like almost more of a, there was more of a community experience happening because there yes. weren't that many. And when one was good, everybody knew it and everybody right. took it home. And you knew, it was like everybody was sort of experiencing it kind of the same time, more or less. And it was, you know, like when Momentum 2 came out, it was like, this is the best of performance surfing. Right. And everybody, that was the word. And so you had to see it. And now it's just like little snippets. And,
yeah,
you know, I can't really say, you know, it's not a good or a bad thing. It's just how it is. And it's, yeah, it's changed a lot. And a lot of times when I'm, you know, like I said, we don't have a TV at our house right now. And then when I'm on the computer, I'm usually just trying to get done and get off of it.
Sure.
So I'm not really sitting down to like settle in and watch a film.
Right.
It doesn't happen that much. So I'm kind of like, oh, I'm going to do a couple of emails and try to get like this ridiculous list of things that it seems is just normal these days with all these devices. I'm like, I'll try to whittle away at it. But I'm not like, oh, I'm going to sit here for 20 minutes
right.
and relax, you well, know, or 45 minutes.
That's
kind of,
that's what we were talking about with the podcast thing too, where it's like, I will watch surf videos, but I'm usually distracted by my phone and other things. Whereas the podcast platform, there's no distraction because you're driving, you know, yeah, whatever
yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting.
Pretty
too.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Just kind of a side note, who are Emmett and Brendan Malloy talking about surf films or films yeah. in general? Are they cousins?
They're my cousins.
Cousins.
Yeah. And they live down in Los Angeles and work on, films down there.
Okay.
And, you know, mostly music films and commercials and stuff like that.
Yeah, I've liked their work.
Yeah,
like I went and saw the screening of Big Easy Express uh-huh. a year or two ago mm-hmm. when that was in. They did it in Santa Monica or mm-hmm. something. Really enjoyed that.
Yeah, they do neat stuff.
And I know they're referred to as the Malloy brothers too. And I'm like, what? That's not the Malloy brothers. That's not, you know. But cool. So are you involved with them at all in projects or just periodically?
From time to time, we'll work together. Chris and Emmett have worked together the most. Chris and Emmett and Jack did Thicker Than Water together.
Right.
So that was, there's definitely a connection there. And yeah, so we've worked together. And I think we'll continue to, you know, when projects sure. come up that it makes sense to.
You know, just another thought about the video clip stuff. It's like, while that Coa Smith barrel probably has had a couple hundred thousand views on it by this point, what you guys are doing with this project and showcasing it at Hobie Surf Shop and various places along California coast isn't going to reach 100,000 people, but you're going to reach 1,000 or a couple thousand core people who are influenced and touched and do remember it, and they come up and get the book signed after the fact. And I feel like that 1,000 people with a strong thumbprint and impression on them really almost has more value than the 100,000 who forget about Coa Slips Smith's clip yeah. as soon as John John releases another one next week. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, I definitely think about that. And I think that that whole thing with, you know, however many hits and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like I was talking about things that are unsettling earlier. And that mm-hmm. to me, it's like, what does that stuff mean? I don't know. And
if it's fleeting.
It's a little bit, I do know what it means a little bit more when you go do an event and, you know, 100 people show up and are excited to sit there and everybody watches a film together and talk right. story afterwards. That I do kind of have an idea of what that feels like and means.
You feel it's like something you feel, you know. Like yeah. You feel it. You're there. You feel it. It's a...
Yeah, and so yeah. I've strayed away from a little bit of the it's funny, like when I think about working on projects, it's still about print.
Is it?
Yeah, it's weird. Like this project, because we had just such a neat little gathering of stuff, I said, hey, Surfline, if you want to do a thing, you can. First time I've ever reached out to them and been like, hey, we did a trip and here's the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And don't have Instagram and just haven't really dove into that thing because I just don't understand it as well.
Sure.
I grew up in print and it still makes sense to me. I still love it. And I still love the idea of going to, you know, a little premiere or a book signing and hearing somebody talk and, you know, I try not to be too nostalgic. I get a ton of my information from the internet for sure.
Yeah.
But I still love that side. And I think there's a little part of it that's becoming even more relevant because it's not normal.
Yep.
And so like the Surfer's Journal, I think, is just as relevant as it's ever been right now, mm-hmm. because they really even more so secured their spot. It's not news.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more of an experience. And I love the idea of having something that you can't just get anywhere, right. you know, and telling a story that not just anybody can tell.
Right.
Like that's what I think the opportunity we all have, you know, cause we've all had such different lives, and that's what, you know, I think like, hey, what can we do that only we can do?
Right.
How can we do it in a way that's interesting to people and they'll have fun with it, and we can start a dialogue between us, and we can basically, like, this trip was an excuse to go hang out with all these people that I'd been dying to hang out with, but hadn't really pulled that off. And in because of the project, I've met all these other people that are, you know, have similar thoughts and beliefs, and it's opened up a lot of other doors. And so there's a really neat cycle that can happen there when you get into the groove of where you know, in the world that you like to work in.
Yeah. It's what you just said touches a lot of points that we kind of already went over but are worth cycling back to, I think, like that Instagram mentality that people live with now, or just being on the phone all the time. It is looking at the world through a viewfinder, you know, and like you said, it's trampling kind of on the experience of life. And so I think it's good for you to not fully partake in it and just kind of try to live life first. And then maybe let's go back and capture it and then showcase some of the experiences.
Yeah, for sure. And the other thing that probably the main reason that I'm not on Instagram is because if I was, I would be on it all day long.
Totally.
Because it's so fun. But yeah.
Another thing that reminded me of, though, was... and the Surfer's Journal was, I interviewed Steve Pesman for the podcast, and he was talking about an interview he did back in the day with Timothy Leary for Surfer magazine when he was at Surfer, and about Leary's theory was that surfers are the most enlightened life forms that there are, because everything, all energy is transferred through waves, and surfers have identified a way to actually ride the wave.
Yeah, so, an actual wave that you can, yeah.
While everybody else is just kind of always in front of the moment or behind the moment, surfers have made a life out of living in the moment and traveling with the moment.
Yeah.
And that's a more enlightened way of being, you know, that's something.
I fully appreciate that, and Steve Pesman's like, oh my god, I don't know what we'd do without him and his wife, and just the journal in general. It's like, god, they breathe life into surfing and the history of surfing and make it a more pleasurable experience, I swear. But whenever I've also had this little gripe with people thinking that surfers are more enlightened, because you look at a lot of the old timers, and I'm not talking about the ones that we get to read about, because obviously they've, like, you know, you look at Jerry Lopez, and the guy's just, he guy freaking is enlightened. It's crazy. He's amazing. But you look at some of the old timers in town, or some of the guys that have really stuck to their one spot, and they're honestly some of the most bitter people I've ever met in my life. So what I, you know, and I, so I think that I was really always impressed by that statement that Timothy Leary, you know, said. And I think that he was obviously very on to some shit.
Yeah.
And very, very had some great things to offer. But I also feel like a lot of people have taken the only the surfer knows the feeling thing too far.
Yeah.
And have kind of gone, you know, I'm a surfer, so I'm basically better than other people. And it hasn't really got them to a more grounded, more enlightened state, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's, I've just thought about that a lot, because from surfing from time to time, surfing in general makes me happy to go do it. Doesn't make me a perfect person, and it hasn't figured out all my problems. Like, yeah. I definitely, you know, and so it's just one of the great tools and one of the great things we get to do. Super lucky, you know, thing that we get to have fun with. And I think when we start to let it get out of that perspective and become, oh my God,
you want to go? All right. You could take it if you need to.
No.
Okay.
When we start to let that perspective go, that, you know, how fortunate we are to get to do it, not that we're special that we get to do it, but that we're really fortunate to get to do it, I think we lose that. And I think that a lot of surfers do, honestly. I feel like a lot of surfers think they're a little bit, you know, got it figured out. And over time, I've just watched a lot of surfers get a little bit more, as surfing changes, as the water gets more crowded, as all these things change, they get a little bit more and more bitter. And I'm like, you know, surfing's not the answer. You got to still stay really creative and figure out ways to enjoy it. I mean, that's, you know, half the reason why I ride boards with no fins and body surf half the time is because I can feel myself starting to get a little bitter about the changes sometimes. And I'll be like, screw it. The moment I feel that, I'm going to try to go do something else, because the only reason why we should be out here is to have a good time and hang out and, you know, whatever.
Yeah. No, I fully agree. And I think that goes back to just having other interests in life and not being all about surfing and let that being the only thing that fulfills you. I know Yvonne was talking about or kind of talks about climbing just being a useless thing, you know, and it's like, yeah, this is useless. And I do it because it is therapy for me and it helps me to enjoy my wife or my time at home with the kids or these other things in my life. But climbing isn't the thing. It's not all about climbing, you know?
Yeah, it was rad. He says, we put all this time and energy and we get to the top and you get up there and there's nothing there. And he's like, so you better start learning how to enjoy the process.
Yeah.
And I've definitely, I've been on trips where you get the best barrels you've ever got in your life. You have an amazing time. You come home and you're still just, you know, I come home and I'm still trying to figure things out. You know, I don't have it all figured out because I got a big stand up barrel and Indo, you know,
right.
It was a great time and I'm not bummed that I was there, but you're not enlightened after that.
Right.
And, you know, and I saw that a lot too, when I was on the tour and got to travel with Kern and Aki. I thought they would be just these crazy freaking yogi dudes that were like just stoked cruising around. And I saw more strife in their, you know, eyes and what they did than almost anybody else I saw. And it was part of my experience that led me to be like, wow, maybe, you know, maybe this isn't the most important thing in the world. You know, Kern, you know, my favorite surfer of all time, and Aki too, you know, world titles, everything you could want, you know, and you know, they're just still people.
Yeah.
And so maybe winning a world title is not going to fix everything, you know, like I thought it was. So, yeah.
I have a couple closing thoughts and questions. Number one, are you watching the Chopu contest right now?
I watched a couple clips the day before yesterday and it was super fun to watch.
When a contest is on, are you rearranging your day to watch it online, or I mean, how involved are you with competitive surfing?
I'm not involved, but I really enjoy it now. I think that the changes in format and everything and being able to watch it online, two waves, oh my God, I wish I could have surfed a heat with two waves.
Yeah.
All that type of stuff's a huge deal. But I watch probably two contests a year, and when they're on, I enjoy every last bit of it. A lot of times I just didn't know they were on.
Okay.
or like I don't check the surf media every day.
Yeah.
When I do and a contest is on and the waves are good, I'm totally like anybody else. I'm like, holy shit, like totally throwing everything aside and really having a hard time focusing on anything else. Like, and the Chopu contest is as good as it gets.
Totally.
And it's crazy because it's like a reunion. It's like watching all my friends, all the new surfers I don't know, but like all the guys, you know, announcing, and a lot of the older crew I do know, and it's really fun to see them all and see what they're up to. And shoot, with the Chopu contest is on, I'm like, yeah, I wish I was there. You know, that would be really fun. It's hard to not want to be there.
Did you see Curran and Aki's Heritage Series heat at J Bay this year?
No. Wait. I saw some footage of Curran, but I don't know if it was that.
Yeah, it probably was.
Yeah.
They ran a heat.
Who won?
Curran.
No way.
Smoked him, dude. Combo.
Wow.
Curran got a 10. You got to see this thing, dude. It's legit.
Oh, my God.
He gets like a barrel and claims it hard. Comes out of the, like while he's coming out of the barrel, sticks his left hand like out first. So you just see his hand waving to the beach. And it's a classic claim too. It's not like pulling his arms down.
Just a weird Kern claim.
Just waving at the beach like a princess or something. It's so rad.
Kern's amazing.
Yeah, Aki surfed good, but yeah. Kern got a 10. So.
Oh, boy.
You got to go back and watch that, though.
Yeah, for sure.
I remember seeing footage of you surfing like Todos Santos and some other big wave spots back in the day. Any interest in big wave surfing nowadays?
Yeah, I have a little bug that definitely keeps me up at night sometimes. I realized over time is that I usually surf wherever I am.
Okay.
And if the waves are big, I go surfing there. Chasing big swells does my head in.
Like, oh, okay.
It's really hard for me to get enough sleep for the 3 or 4 days before. I'm stressing and nervous and all that stuff. But if I can settle in a place and you know, I go to Hawaii every year still. And when it's big there, I really enjoy being out in the water. I really enjoy being around the crew that's doing that. There's definitely an entirely new level.
Yeah.
You know, that I am not even close to. Like, this year when I was on Oahu, Jaws was going to be really good. And I specifically was like, I'm not going over there. I think there's, like, an older school of thought and surfing. And I'm pretty good friends with Shane Dorian. And I know that he surfs out almost every time it gets good, and I feel like there's a certain amount of like training and time and energy that would need to go in for me to go to a place like that. And totally. Knowing Shane, I didn't want to show up with Shane there and be like, "Hey, dude, I'm here too. I'm trying to get the shot," you know, right. Like, and that's what a big part of the crew is going over there. And so that's not really something. I don't think I'll ever surf Jaws again. I surfed it once on towed it a long time ago, got an invite to go over there, but I don't think I'll ever go over there in the way that it is now. It's amazing though, and it's big wave surfing. Another thing I feel bad for the kids now, big wave surfing when we were around wasn't even recognized by the companies. Mm-hmm. You know, and most of the big wave surfing that we did, there was no cameras around, and there was like, you know, the outer reefs were like a handful of people, and I barely got to sneak into a couple. Like I got the very tail end of that era, and you know, I got a handful of sessions that were just amazing. But it's changed a lot too. And if you want to be a big wave surfer now, you got to go get barreled at Jaws. I'm like, right. I feel sorry for you guys. That's so gnarly. You know?
It is, but it's also a lot more safety precautions in place too.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It is mind blowing to me that more people don't die.
Yeah. What are Chris and Keith up to?
They're raising families.
Okay.
Up north, making films and raising families. You know?
Nice.
Yeah, they're both living up, you know, up north and surfing quite a bit and, you know, still working on film projects and book projects. And Chris has got 2 little ones. Keith's got a second one on the way. And still hit the road when a trip that's enticing enough comes around.
Yeah.
And, yeah, still feel like I pretty
see-
busy.
I feel like I see their names behind the camera, you know, more than in front of.
Yeah, I think nowadays. We all kind of enjoy that a little bit more these days, you know?
Yeah. What's your current travel schedule look like? I mean, how frequently are you on the road nowadays?
I'm on the road. Like right now, I'm going to the Aleutian Islands.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on September 2nd for 2.5 weeks on a boat.
Who's that?
It's with Doc Reniker.
Okay.
It's a commercial fishing boat called the Milo, and so we're heading up that way. And after that, I'll be in Hawaii a couple different times this winter, and then I'll be as home as much as I can. Like I said, we have a place where there's plenty of work to get done.
Sure.
I need to spend a lot of time there this winter too.
So, cool. Very cool. Yeah. Are there any surfing stories? I know you have a pretty fond reverence for kind of history and surf history. Are there any surf stories that you'd like to hear told, whether it's video format or book that hasn't been told yet or written yet?
Well, let's see if I can think of... well, one that always stands out to me is, you know, Todd Chesser's story is a really great story, but I also... you know, I think it could be an unbelievable film and stuff like that. But at the same time, it's like, you don't want to desecrate something that's so perfect, you know? Totally. So, I mean, it's an amazing story, but I don't, and part of me doesn't care if it ever gets told because it's pretty perfect in my mind how it is. But, you know, as far as surfing history goes, and I'm trying to think, like, I do this when I'm trying to think of names, but there are so many people that were instrumental in you know, making surfing what it is today, and they're getting older, and they're in that older generation. You know, we just had Donald Takayama pass away, and there's so many people from his age, older, that there's so much history there to be learned by our generation. And
right.
I feel like we spend a lot of our time just like seeing a kid do a new rotation or this different thing, which is super fun, but there's like all this stuff that will never, like I was saying before, getting these stories that can't be told by anybody else. There's a lot of people that have those right now,
right?
Like I said, I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah.
But you know, I think it's really interesting to look into the places close to home and find the old surfers nearby that have been around forever and get those neat old stories. So there's not any specific ones coming to mind right now, but there are a million out there.
For sure there are.
And I like those. I do like the stories of how surfing came around to be how it is today.
Yeah. Final question for everybody interviewed. Mm. What's the last board that you rode?
Let's see. A couple days ago. Well, I did the body surfing world championships at Oceanside last weekend.
I didn't even know that happened. Yeah. In Oceanside. Oh man.
Yeah, lost in the semis. It's
bummer.
Not. It's not.
Why is it in Oceanside?
I don't know. It's not really the like. It's not the. It's called the Body Surfing World Championships, but it's okay. Not. It's a super fun event, amazing gathering. It's my first time doing it, but it's really about the gathering. But it's not like, you know, Mike Stewart's there and a bunch of the crew that are like the best of all time. Right. There's a bunch of great body surfers there. But so that's the last thing I did. Before that was just, I think it was this finless kind of plank piece of shit that I have. It's not a very good board, but I just went out to get a couple waves to kind of blow some steam off.
Nice.
Emma Wood.
Finless, do you know who made it? Or?
It was originally a Greg Little, and then I cut it up, like Derek Hine style.
Nice.
Yeah.
I watched in preparation for this that I think the Surfer's Journal maybe produced it, that board swap with Dane Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
I think, was that board in there? I remember
it was before. I made this one after, but okay. We had a bunch of funky boards.
Well, you pointed out a board made by Greg Little in that thing, so
yeah.
I didn't know if that was the same board or
not. Oh, it might be the same board before I chopped it up.
Oh, okay, maybe. Yeah. I don't know if you wrote it or not, but you pointed out.
Yeah, those boards are hard to ride, and they're very specific, and to be honest, there's very few times I will ride them. A lot of people are really into them, and it's a little confusing to me because they're only good for certain very super specific waves, in my opinion. And I see people riding them at beach breaks and stuff like that, and I'm like, man, it's just hard to do. They're so hard to ride.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, if you ever get on Instagram, Derek Hine's Instagram is pretty rad.
Is it?
Totally.
No way.
He posts the sickest photos.
What's it called?
Farfield Traction or something, or Far From Traction.
Far From Traction.
Something like that.
Yeah, that makes me want to get
Freeform,
on Instagram.
Yeah.
Rad.
I'll show it to you. All right, right on. Thank
All
you.
All right, thanks.
Yeah.
All right, appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. Dan and Kellen's new book and DVD combo is available through Patagonia Books. You can find a link to it on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. Also, make sure to come by the website to see tons of video footage that I was able to find of Dan Malloy ripping over the past few years, and really interesting stuff finless surfing, traditional surfing, a little bit of everything. Definitely worth watching. And the book, I highly recommend picking up as well. Really enjoyable. Thank you, Dan, for joining us on the show. We really appreciate it. Kellen, it was great to meet you as well. And if you're new to Surf Splendor, all past episodes are archived for free on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. If you listen in iTunes or Stitcher, everything's available there as well. If you do listen in one of those platforms, just make sure to rate and review the show. That helps with our show's ranking, and it helps for other people to find the show. So make sure you do that, and then follow us on social media at Surf Splendor. It's a great way to share the show with friends and also to see a lot of the ancillary content that accompanies each episode in the form of video and photos and all that sort of stuff. If you enjoy the music of Surf Splendor, we've dedicated a page on our website to house all the songs from every episode, and there's even a Spotify player embedded on the site, so you can just go and click play and listen through all the music from every episode. So enjoy that. And lastly, if you enjoy Surf Splendor and you'd like to see the show grow, the way that you can invest in the show's future is simply to share it with a friend. You are our only form of advertising, so make sure to spread the word, and we will continue getting A-list guests like Dan and Kellen. So thank you for doing that. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Kellen. And really enjoyed my time with you guys, and I appreciate you just taking a lot of time and giving thoughtful responses to all of my probing questions. So until next week, this is David Scales signing off for Surf Splendor and saying ciao.